The U.S. Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board held a town hall meeting yesterday at UW-Superior about the Husky Energy Refinery explosion and fire on April 26th. This public meeting was requested by five members of Congress, including U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. We're talking about what happened at the town hall on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's bring in Danielle Kading. She's covered every development in the Husky disaster. She's WPR's reporter based in Superior and the host of the regional program Hear Me Out. Danny, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Kate.
Well, before we go into what happened at the town hall yesterday, take us back to that April day when the fire and explosion rocked Superior.
Yeah, so at around 10 o'clock in the morning, there was a large explosion at the refinery. And investigators have said that that occurred in the fluid catalytic cracking unit, which is used to transform crude oil components like hydrocarbons. It's basically cracked. The molecules are cracked and transformed into gasoline or a substance like gasoline. And as part of that process, there was a valve that was supposed to be closed and prevent a flammable mixture from forming, because there are two separate parts of this piece of equipment, and they want to keep those hydrocarbons in one part from mixing with air in another part. Otherwise, an explosion can happen. And so what ended up happening is that this valve became worn and allowed air to flow backwards. And that caused the explosion, which sent debris flying throughout the refinery. It punctured a nearby asphalt tank that had about 50,000 barrels of asphalt in it. And about 15,000 of that spilled into the refinery and later caught fire. And then that fire burned until about just before 7 o'clock in the evening that night, and caused, you know, a temporary evacuation of a large portion of the city.
So we seem to really know quite a bit about what happened here. What big questions remain now after the smoke cleared?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that the Chemical Safety Board is continuing to look into. You know, they're looking at the circumstances that led to this situation, which was similar to another refinery incident in Torrance, California, that involved ExxonMobil's refinery. That also had a worn valve that was used. But investigators say it's not clear whether, you know, a new valve might have prevented this. It's unclear how long a slide valve can operate constantly and maintain that barrier to prevent flammable mixtures from forming. But and the investigator, Mark Wingard, said, you know, we have refineries across the U.S. that are operating every day using the same process, and we're not constantly seeing explosions. This particular unit at the refinery had been in operation since 1961, and they had not had an incident until now. So they're still looking at a lot of the actual circumstances of the explosion. They're also talking with the refinery about staffing and safety management processes and procedures to see, you know, whether or not everything was as it should have been.
Danny, how has this disaster, this incident, affected Superior over time?
That's a good question. I think people immediately were just going through the motions of the evacuation and doing what they were told to be done by authorities. But I think over time, people, as they've learned more about what happened and about what was contained at the refinery, they feel kind of shocked. Some people at the hearing yesterday expressed the fact that they didn't know that the refinery used this type of chemical, hydrogen fluoride, which was within about, there was a tank of it within about 150 feet of the explosion. And so I think over time, people have gone from feeling that everything was taken care of as it should be, to asking more questions about how things were done and what things could be improved to make Superior and the Twin Ports and the surrounding area more safe moving into the future.
We're talking with Danielle Kading, WPR's reporter based in Superior. She's been covering the aftermath of the Husky refinery disaster and a town hall meeting yesterday. You can join in with your questions and how you feel. 800-642-1234. Superior residents, how did the explosion and fire affect you? What concerns do you have moving forward? And what questions do you have about the investigation? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Danny, federal officials offered an update on the investigation as part of yesterday's meeting. What were the latest takeaways? You had started talking about hydrofluoric acid.
Yeah, I mean, there were questions that were asked by the board members about hydrogen fluoride in the tank on site. They asked a variety of questions about the layout of refineries and, you know, if these units are subject to explode every once in a while, maybe the hydrogen fluoride tank should be located far away from this actual unit. But it that chemical is used as a catalyst in the process. So I'm sorry, Kate, I forgot your initial question.
And, well, we have some tape here. CSB board member Rick Engler. Let's hear from him.
There's enough, I think, consensus among many, although I certainly think there will be disagreements among industry management on this, that hydrofluoric acid alkylation poses a potentially severe risk to communities. And the CSB needs to take very seriously some type of action steps to move this question forward.
So is the Chemical Safety Board going to rein in companies in their use of hydrofluoric acid?
I think it's definitely something that they're looking at as part of the investigation into the incident. You know, the actual explosion itself began in the fluid catalytic cracking unit and then was caused downstream after this flammable mixture was allowed to form and found an ignition source. So they're going to be looking at a variety of things. They're constrained to looking at the facts of the case, and those in the refinery industry that were there yesterday talked about how the Chemical Safety Board really needs to focus on where the problem was, what caused the explosion. I think now that there's a lot of heightened awareness about the use of hydrogen fluoride, that there are different perspectives on whether or not that is a good chemical to be using right now. Obviously, communities surrounding these facilities have raised questions about the safety and feel that there are better alternatives that could be put in place that would still allow the company to operate and not put the community at such a risk. While the refinery industry says, you know, they meet and exceed regulatory requirements for using hydrogen fluoride.
The Chemical Safety Board held a town hall meeting yesterday in Superior. It was a time for the agency to provide an update on its inquiry into the Husky Refinery April explosion and fire. People could make comments there for the record for up to 3 minutes. We're getting takeaways from that meeting with WPR's reporter in Superior. Danielle Kading stays with us. You can join in with your questions and your situation 7 months after the disaster. 800-642-1234. What questions, concerns do you have moving forward? What questions do you have about the investigation? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We recall the images of that black plume of smoke from the Husky refinery fire in Superior. A set of explosions ripped through the refinery, developing into a giant fire, spreading black smoke for miles. The Chemical Safety Board opened an investigation and provided an update to the public yesterday at a town hall meeting in Superior. We're finding out what was said here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. WPR's reporter in Superior, Danny Kading, stays with us, getting your questions, your thoughts on the investigation. They're welcome, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Danny, that hearing included the option for people to make public comments on the record. What was the mood of the room?
Well, I think the majority of the comments were kind of angry, and they demanded action on hydrogen fluoride. People, you know, some people talked about where they were on that day, the smoke and the smells, but really most of the comments surrounded the use of that chemical and how they felt it should be removed. You know, both mayors here have called for it to be removed. And, you know, a lot of community members voiced frustration with public officials because they feel leaders should be putting more pressure on Husky to transition away from hydrogen fluoride.
What was turnout like at the meeting?
I would say there were at least 100 to 150 people at the meeting during the first part of it the other day. You know, there were fewer people that came back after the lunch break, mm-hmm. but there were a good number of people who were there. Not all of them spoke. I think it was only about 24 people that actually spoke at the meeting. And there were only, I think, 2 people who spoke on behalf of the refinery. And that included the Husky electrician and union district director, Atticus Larson, and also an industry representative for American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, Jared Hawes.
So going back to the hydrogen fluoride, what's been the relationship between community members and city officials when it comes to this issue? Are they on the same page?
Well, the two mayors of Duluth and Superior, Superior Mayor Jim Payne and Duluth Mayor Emily Larson, came out shortly after the explosion and fires and said that they wanted the refinery to look at other safer alternatives and called for the removal of hydrogen fluoride. But activists in the area have questioned whether leaders in the area are, you know, holding up to that stance and are, you know, talking with leaders at the refinery to, you know, really kind of push them to move away from this chemical.
Let's hear from one of those voices, Ginger Jewell, co-founder of the Twin Ports Action Alliance.
Jim Payne doesn't want to talk about hydrogen fluoride anymore. Jim Payne has told constituents as recently as last week that hydrogen fluoride is less dangerous than automobiles.
So that is very accusatory. Let's hear from Superior Mayor Jim Payne.
We want to keep a refinery in the city of Superior. It is valuable to our economy, but we must make sure that we are protecting our citizens, our employees, and our first responders before any other consideration.
So what is the dynamic here, the push-pull over this issue of hydrogen fluoride?
Yeah, I think that there is a lot of frustration on both sides. I think for the activists, they want to see everything done to, you know, everything in their power to remove this chemical from the refinery. There's a lot of fear surrounding it. They don't want it there. They want to reduce the risks to the community. And I think in trying to convey that message, they have put off members of the public and public officials, that they have been very, as you said, accusatory, and that is being met with pushback from elected leaders. You know, they have said that, you know, some of these claims of the actual risks of that day and the fires and the explosion and hydrogen fluoride releasing have been overblown. And I think that is, to some extent, you know, there's this figure floating out there that there is a kill zone of 180,000 surrounding the refinery if that hydrogen fluoride tank were to be released. But that's if the tank was completely full.
Well, isn't that about the population of Superior?
That is not the population of Superior. The population of Superior is about 27,000, the village. But, you know, going back to this hazard risk mitigation plan that the county has put together, they have identified that in a worst case scenario, that an area of up to 26 miles could be evacuated.
Uh-huh.
But that is the worst case scenario. On that day, there was not as much product in that hydrogen fluoride tank that would warrant, you know, evacuating rural Douglas, St. Louis, or Carlton counties.
A mass evacuation. Yeah.
So I think that people who are afraid are saying, we need to do something about this. And public officials are saying, you're making people scared. And there's just a disconnect there of how to go forward and improve safety in the area.
So let's look at employees themselves. The Husky plant has about 180 employees. How are they doing and what are they saying?
The employees? Well, yeah. So we don't hear a whole lot from Husky workers in the area. Sometimes they will come out to the public meetings. The union district director, Atticus Larson,
and we
for
have
Husky.
We have some tape of that. Go ahead and set it up.
Yeah, he was there at the meeting yesterday, and he spoke about issues he'd like to see addressed with training and safety and procedures at the plant.
Let's take a listen.
And although Husky is new to the employees, and we are really still getting to know each other stage, I believe Husky will do it right. And do it safely. Husky has been a class act. They have done this to this point, everything they said they would. They have followed every recommendation, to my knowledge, that was given to them from outside agencies.
Husky is new to the employees. We're really still in the getting to know each other phase. Help us understand what he's saying here.
So Husky bought the refinery in November of 2017 mm-hmm. from the former owner, Calumet. So there's some questions there as to whether or not Husky adopted some issues from the former owner and is now dealing with those. And one of the things that Atticus Larson talked about was culture change. And he sort of hinted that maybe the culture at the refinery right now isn't what it should be, and that more should be done by management and by Husky corporate to address that so that they can improve safety, improve training, and improve operations at the refinery.
Is there a sense that broader recommendations may come from this investigation? Will this investigation advance safety?
I think that the investigators and the board members are looking at any takeaways that could be learned, you know, and applied to the industry as a whole. One of the things that they talked about was that worn valve that led to the explosion, and looking at that further and seeing if there are any recommendations that they can make so that the industry as a whole is safer in operating, especially across communities that still have refineries with hydrogen fluoride being used there.
And Danny, how long do investigations like these take?
These investigations typically take a year to about a year and a half. So sometime next year, the CSB will issue their final report, and that could extend into the fall.
Does the CSB have the ability to issue penalties here?
No, they don't. Their authority really lies with making recommendations on improving safety across the industry and operations. They don't issue fines like OSHA did, although OSHA, the worker safety arm mm-hmm. for the federal government, did issue fines to the company back in October of around $83,000 for 8 serious violations of safety procedures.
So we had this town hall meeting. What comes next for the investigation? Where does it go from here?
Well, now they're going to take some of the information from the meeting and continue to look at those issues that board members ask questions about, like staffing and safety management processes and procedures. You know, they're continuing their investigation. They've interviewed more than 50 people and gathered more than 14,000 documents. And so they're going to continue to go through all of that and look at other instances that have occurred at other refineries and kind of compare and examine, you know, what might yet be improved as a result of this incident.
That's a lot of documents to go through.
That is a lot of documents.
Where does your reporting go from here on Husky? What are you watching for?
Well, obviously, I guess the outcome of the investigation, I think people want to know how Husky is going to respond to public criticism over the use of hydrogen fluoride. They have said that they have hired a design contractor and that they're looking at alternatives to hydrogen fluoride, but they've not made a commitment to transition away from that chemical, although there's a lot of pressure on them to do that.
Well, Danielle Kading, thank you so much for taking time for us.
Thanks, Kate.
Danielle Kading is WPR's reporter in Superior, host of the regional program Hear Me Out. For more on the public meeting, you can also listen to Hear Me Out, a regional program hosted by Danny at 10 a.m. on Fridays, which will review this hearing, and the audio will be posted on the Hear Me Out page at WPR.org. Stay with us. You're listening to the Ideas Network. According to estimates from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, roughly a third of Wisconsin's counties do not have any OBGYNs, and there are about 550 OBGYNs serving more than 2.5 million women in Wisconsin. With those numbers in mind, we're looking at bipartisan legislation that's awaiting the president's signature called the Improving Access to Maternity Care Act. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin is on the line from her office in Washington, and she was a co-sponsor of this bill with Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski. Senator Baldwin, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So before we get to maternal care and provider shortages, let's take a quick look at the latest news out of Washington since we have this opportunity with you. First of all, this government shutdown that is looming over the issue of border security. And if the president follows through on that threat, about a quarter of the federal government would begin to run out of money in about 8 days. Democrats and Republicans are really far apart on funding this wall. Where do you stand on this and how do you plan to vote?
Well, first of all, in the Congress, I think that Democrats and Republicans have come to a consensus about the remaining spending bills that we want to send to the president. And included in there is the funding bill for the Homeland Security Agency, which has as a big part of its charge border security and port security. Both houses of Congress have agreed on a figure of $1.6 billion for border security. But we've relied on expert advice from our Homeland Security Department and others on what form that should take. And most of the experts agree that in some places a wall might be appropriate, but in many others are far superior security measures for our border. And the problem, as I see it, is our president, is insisting upon a concrete wall and isn't able to make Mexico pay for it, as he suggested during his entire campaign for president. And so he is, he said he'd be proud to shut down the government over this this dispute. But I want to see the government keep open. I know my Republican colleagues want to see the government keep open and running. And there's absolutely no need for this this threat, as far as I'm concerned. There's no reason for President Trump to shut down the U.S. government because he hasn't been able to, keep his promise to have Mexico pay for a border wall at our southern border. But border security is a key priority in the funding bills that we would like to send to the president.
So somehow you're going to have to bridge that gap between $5 billion and $1.6 billion. There's going to have to be a lot of compromise in there.
There will be. I think the most responsible thing for us to do is pass agreed-upon legislation funding the remaining part of the government, as you mentioned, somewhere between 20 and 25% of the funding is left to make it through Congress. And, you know, if the president wants to reject that, that's his choice. But I think we could send him, with strong bipartisan agreement in the Congress, both houses, could send him the remaining funding bills for his signature.
Well, Congress just passed an $867 billion farm bill this week that had broad bipartisan support. You supported the 2019 farm bill, while Republican Senator from Wisconsin Ron Johnson voted against it. How do you think the bill will affect Wisconsin?
Well, our agricultural sector is in enormous stress and turmoil right now. Particularly, as you know, Wisconsin is America's dairyland. Our dairy farmers are in particular troublesome times right now. It's been almost a perfect storm of adverse conditions. So the price of milk has been low for a number of years now. There's an oversupply. And then you add to that issues like retaliatory tariffs from Mexico and China on cheese products, and we're the number one producer of cheese in the country, as well as retaliatory tariffs against some of our specialty crops in Wisconsin, like cranberries, for example. We've had such stress, and this farm bill really begins to provide meaningful relief, particularly in the dairy industry. What dairy farmers need is a way to manage their risk for the good years and the bad years. And the risk management tools that were added to the last farm bill that was passed a little over 5 years ago, those haven't worked the way they were intended to. So they have been strengthened significantly. And what dairy farmers can expect is to pay lower premiums, but have more robust coverage so that the program for risk management really begins to recognize the losses that they face on a monthly basis when the price for milk is so low, and these other actions like the retaliatory tariffs have weighed in to make the situation even worse.
Talking with U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin about issues swirling around Capitol Hill. She was also co-sponsor of the Improving Access to Maternity Care Act, where we'll turn our attention to now. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Are you a mother in rural Wisconsin? What was your prenatal experience? If you're a woman's health physician, what is your take on this issue? You can call in at 800-642-1234, tweet us WPR Mornings. So this bill that you co-sponsored passed the Senate this week, the Improving Access to Maternity Care Act. What inspired you to co-sponsor this bill?
Well, in part, it was hearing from expectant mothers in Wisconsin and hearing stories like Rachel's. Rachel is a mother who lives in Sister Bay, Wisconsin. That's Door County. And she shared with me her story of driving 90 minutes to Green Bay in labor just to locate a doctor who could deliver her second baby. And that is the situation faced by way too many in Wisconsin who live in rural areas where there is no maternity care available in their home communities. And we know that good prenatal care, regular prenatal care, is essential to leading to healthier babies and healthier mothers, healthier pregnancies and births. If you do not receive prenatal care, there's a 3 times greater likelihood for low birth weight, and frankly, the receiving no prenatal care can lead to 5 times more greater likelihood that a baby might die.
So, Senator,
and we
How is
we can do something about it.
How is this bill? Yeah, how is this bill going to improve health care for rural Wisconsinites? What in it is going to change the situation?
So this is a two-pronged approach intended to bring maternity care services to underserved areas. So right now, the federal government looks at where there is inadequate access to certain types of health care, and it's focused so far on inadequate access to primary care, mental health services, and dental care. But they do not specifically look at inadequate access to maternity care. So we are now instructing the agency that looks at these issues to be very specific about where there's a gap for maternity care. And then the second prong of this measure is to work with the National Health Services Corps, which specializes in putting trained obstetricians and gynecologists, as well as advanced practice maternity care nurses, in areas that are underserved. And so this two-pronged approach is a very cost-effective way of beginning to close this gap that too many rural women in America face.
And Senator Baldwin, Philomenia in Ashland, Wisconsin here would love to get a point in. Philomenia, go ahead.
Oh, hi, Philomena Quebec. So one of the things that we're dealing with here in northern Wisconsin is this epidemic of opioids. And there are a lot of pregnant women in my community in Bend River who are dependent on opioids when they become pregnant. And we don't also have enough doctors who are waivered to do Suboxone. The other issue that we also deal with sometimes is these women end up in jail.
And Philomenia, I have to cut you off there, and I think Senator Baldwin can have a moment here to respond to you on the opioids and pregnant women.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, in my trips to Ashland in particular, over the past few years, I've had occasion to host roundtables and stakeholder meetings on the opioid epidemic specifically in Ashland. And I know that the first time I visited, there was really not a lot of treatment resources available in the immediate community. And working together, there has been a significant step forward to close that gap with a community health clinic that is now able to expand their provision of behavioral health services, including addiction services.
And we have to stop right there, Senator Baldwin. Thank you so much for joining us. That was U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin talking about her legislation on maternal care. We'll continue this conversation here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. UW-Madison's Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology offers a rural residency training track providing specific training for physicians in rural women's health. This as Wisconsin and the country faces a shortage of doctors, especially in rural areas. We're talking about it here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Dr. Ryan Spencer oversees UW-Madison's Rural OBGYN Residency Program. Dr. Spencer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kate.
And so as we look at the situation in rural parts of Wisconsin, I really want to set it up with Zach in Wapaka, who is joining us. Zach, go ahead. What do you see as a family doctor?
Thanks for taking my call. So one of the things at the front line in a rural place, I work at a critical access hospital, is opportunities for family docs and general surgeons to train to do C-sections. The rural continuity clinic, or the rural clinic with OBGYN, is a great idea. It's just there isn't any massive workforce that's going to be coming out of that program. And the vast majority of C-sections and maternity care in rural places is general surgeons, family docs, and midwives.
Thank you so much for that call, Zach. So really seeing that you have to do a number of different things in rural areas that you really can't specialize.
I really appreciate Zach's call and comments that he has. There's so much work to be done, especially in the state of Wisconsin, where almost 40% of counties don't have an OBGYN doctor. Zach brings out a great point in that there are opportunities both in general surgery for rural training, family medicine, as well as OBGYN, and that's why we've decided to start the program, our rural training track.
So this rural residency program started in 2016. The first residents matched in 2017. How is this program doing? It lasts 4 years, and how is it going?
We think it's going remarkably well, and I should say all credit goes to two individuals, Ellen Hartenbach and Jody Silva, who really took this program from its infancy and made it the success it already is today. The point of the program is to select an individual each year who has specific interest in working in a rural location after residency, and during their training provide them opportunities to understand what it's like to practice in those communities and be a part of those communities.
And so how many people are in the residency program?
Our total residency class is 7 residents per year. One of them is selected as the rural training track.
So that's not a lot of residents there. As Zach said, I mean, we need a massive amount. So how do you reconcile that?
One thing, as you heard from Senator Baldwin just minutes ago, that's one pathway, is to be able to provide opportunities for physicians already in practice who want to move into rural communities. And then the other approach is what we're taking is, well, now small, trying to inspire other places around the country to start their own rural training tracks. And we've had opportunities to receive calls from many places about how to start this type of program. In fact, in February, we're traveling down to New Orleans to present at our National Education Conference on how to begin and sustain a program like we have here in Wisconsin.
Once you see residents get into rural areas, do you find that they evolve in some way, their perspective about practicing in a rural area?
Well, we know from data from studies that people who have a rural training experience are 2 to 3 times more likely to go into a rural setting to practice. I can tell you anecdotally, in our residents who've gone to these rural sites so far, they come back with an excitement about what they've experienced. They really seem to just take on this idea that they're going to become part of a small community and not only practice, but be an integral piece in that community to improve the health there.
But let's look at the trade-offs here. I mean, is it true that rural specialists would be working longer hours, probably traveling around a region to smaller clinics to see patients who may not have insurance, perhaps paid less than an urban doctor who would practice in a well-appointed clinic or hospital and see patients who do have insurance? I mean, there's a lot of trade-offs there.
There are a lot of challenges. And I will say, everyone who picks a practice type in medicine goes into it trying to understand what the pros and cons of that practice are. I will also tell you, when you have a love and a passion for what you want to do, some of those things that at the outset may seem significant fade away a little bit. And I can see that in our residents in this track, that they're eyes wide open as to the challenges of practicing in smaller communities. But when they go there, they have a specific love to practice in those communities because most of them are from there. They see the need. They want to fulfill the need.
What are the biggest challenges they face being a physician in rural parts of Wisconsin?
I think you bring up a lot of good points just moments ago. Sometimes it can feel like a smaller setting in a community. You may not feel like you have the support that you've had in bigger settings during your training time, so that may be one of them. I think that we are trying to prepare our trainees as much as possible for the realities of what they might face. And practicing with those doctors during their training program, they can pick their brain. They can ask them how they manage challenging situations in their day-to-day practice so they, when they get out into practice, they can hit the ground running and not have to worry about what those challenges are and how to solve them. They already have an idea of how to work through those.
Talking with Dr. Ryan Spencer, who oversees UW-Madison's Rural OBGYN Residency Program, looking at the issues that are faced by physicians who practice in rural areas and to get residents into rural communities, specifically who have training in obstetrics and gynecology. You can join in with your situation, what you've seen, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Spencer, how have the communities involved in this program responded to it in the first few years?
We have remarkable community partners. Right now, we have residents set up to go into Portage, Waupun, and Monroe. We're out there pounding the pavement right now looking for additional partners. We were just up in Baldwin, Wisconsin, had a lovely visit at Western Wisconsin Health. We're going over to Sauk Prairie soon, as well into Dodgeville. So we're really trying to get a really robust and varied experience for the residents in this track.
So more settings perhaps would mean more residents. Is that right? Or...
Well, our hope certainly is, if this continues to be successful and we're able to have logistics and funding available, that we could expand the program. And like you said, one at a time is a slow drip. We'd like to not only in Wisconsin but other parts of the country open up these programs to increase the amount of physicians wanting to practice in rural settings, taking advantage of what we're seeing in the improving access to Maternity Care Act.
Dr. Spencer, what are some of the negative impacts a woman may face if she doesn't get the proper maternity care, prenatal care?
What we see is improved access is improved outcomes for moms and babies. And that means less women with complications of pregnancy in settings where they may not be able to take care of them adequately. Improvements in low birth weight infants, and improvements in maternal and neonatal mortality.
So you can actually see that in the data.
We know that if a woman gets the appropriate amount of prenatal care at the appropriate setting at the right time, outcomes are improved across the board.
So earlier this hour, we spoke with Senator Tammy Baldwin about the Improving Access to Maternity Health Care Act. Specifically, do you think this legislation will help address issues facing women here in rural Wisconsin?
I think it will. I think what we're going to see is, as we dedicate resources into these communities, physicians are going to understand that they're valued in those communities. They're going to look at those jobs at an increasing rate. And I think people are going to have a better opportunity to provide the kind of care they've always been used to in any type of setting.
So as we also saw through this legislation, there's not only a focus on OBGYNs, but a focus on nurses with specialties in women's health, nurse practitioners. Is that part of the formula here to address women's health in rural areas?
We don't specifically have a piece in our program since we train physicians specifically, but I can tell you advanced practice providers like certified midwives are certainly a wonderful area that can enrich these communities and provide really important care as well.
Do you see a future where, in order for you to really get physicians to practice and stay in rural America, that you will have to start this type of training early on in their medical student career?
That's a great point. There are programs that do so. Wisconsin has one. It's called the Wisconsin Academy for Rural Medicine, or WARM. Other states around the country who have state-sponsored medical schools have similar programs for that exact reason. We know that people that have an inkling or an interest in rural medicine, if they get those experiences and see how rewarding they can be, are way more likely to end up practicing in rural communities.
Well, Dr. Spencer, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Kate. Thank you.
Dr. Ryan Spencer is an assistant professor in the UW-Madison Gynecologic Oncology Program. He oversees the Rural OBGYN Residency Program. Just ahead, we learn what happens to our data when we die. Majority of Americans don't prepare for this, and we'll dig into why. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.